Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa, is covered in ash and dust after the submarine volcanic eruption at the weekend, but the situation is calm there and first clean-up efforts are being made, UN humanitarians said on Monday. Further afield in the Pacific Island nation, an update from Aid Coordinating Office OCHA indicated that there has been significant damage to infrastructure around the main island of Tongatapu, where several resorts have been destroyed or badly damaged in western coastal areas. There are no confirmed fatalities so far, but two people are still missing and assessments are still pending, particularly from the outer islands. According to reports, Saturday's eruption was heard as far away as Alaska, while the tsunami that emanated from the blast flooded the Japanese and US coastlines, also killing two people in Peru. So far in Tonga, no official contact has been established with two small low-lying islands, Mango and Fonoi, although surveillance flights by New Zealand and Australia have revealed substantial damage along western beaches. The Taliban in Afghanistan is institutionalizing large-scale systematic discrimination and violence against women and girls, UN-appointed independent rights experts have warned. The alert follows the Taliban takeover last August, which has seen a series of restrictive measures against women and girls that amount to collective punishment. These include imposing a strict dress code, barring women from returning to their jobs, and requiring a male relative to accompany them in public spaces. There's particular concern about the continued denial of access to secondary and tertiary education on the premise that women and men have to be segregated and that female students abide by a specific dress code. Religious or linguistic minorities such as the Hazara, Tajik, Hindu or other communities have also become more vulnerable in Afghanistan, the experts said, highlighting reports of extrajudicial killings which would suggest deliberate efforts to target, ban and even eliminate them from the country. The result of the de facto leadership's policies is that women and particularly female heads of household are now struggling to make a living and being pushed further into poverty, the experts insisted. As the dire humanitarian crisis continues in Afghanistan, the rights experts noted that any aid response, recovery or development efforts would be sure to fail if female relief staff, women-led organizations and women in general continue to be excluded from the process. To the Horn of Africa now, where the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, has appealed for more than $138 million in urgent funding to help 1.5 million people. Rural communities are particularly vulnerable because their fields and pasture have been hit hard by an extended drought. The region is prone to food insecurity, natural resource limitations and conflict, and FAO said on Monday that the COVID-19 pandemic and 2020 to 2021 locust infestation have stretched the coping capacities of rural communities to the limit. The worry is that a third season of drought, driven by La Nina, could spark a large-scale hunger crisis if the region's food-producing rural communities do not receive adequate assistance ahead of upcoming agricultural seasons. The worst affected countries are Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia, where projections indicate that more than 25 million people face high acute food insecurity by mid-2022. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have rejected a plan by their party's leaders to change Senate rules to allow passage of two major voting rights bills. Speaking from the Senate floor Thursday, Senator Sinema said she would not vote to change the filibuster, even if she claimed to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act.
There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. And there's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy.
Sinema was joined later on Thursday by West Virginia's Joe Manchin, who said he too would oppose a change in the filibuster. Their opposition all but dooms the prospect of the 117th Congress will pass voting rights legislation. President Biden reacted to the news.
I hope we can get this done. The honest to God answer is I don't know whether we can get this done.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Senate will delay a scheduled January recess to take up voting rights legislation Tuesday, one day after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. The Supreme Court has struck down the Biden administration's requirement that workers at large private companies get vaccinated against COVID-19 or be tested weekly. The court's conservative majority ruled the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, overstepped its authority when it ordered the mandate affecting some 84 million private sector workers. In a dissenting opinion, Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor wrote, quote, "Today we are not wise. In the face of a still raging pandemic, this court tells the agency charged with protecting worker safety that it may not do so in all the workplaces needed," they wrote. In a separate 5-4 decision, justices upheld a vaccination requirement for Medicare and Medicaid providers covering about 10 million healthcare workers nationwide. As the winter COVID surge continues to worsen, President Biden said he would make another $500 million rapid antigen tests available for free to U.S. households. The White House had already announced the purchase of $500 million tests in December, but those kits have not yet been distributed. Here in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams said Thursday he's discussing plans for a temporary remote learning option with the United Federation of Teachers. Adams had vowed to keep classrooms open when he was sworn in just 2 weeks ago, but up to a third of students in the nation's largest school district have been absent from classrooms this week. The FBI arrested the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia Thursday, charging him and 10 others with seditious conspiracy over the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Prosecutors say 56-year-old Stuart Rhodes organized a plot to oppose the lawful transfer of presidential power by force. They charge Oath Keepers under Rhodes' command spread out in a military formation inside the Capitol looking for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, while a heavily armed quick reaction force stood by at a hotel just outside Washington, ready to take action. Encrypted messages sent by Rhodes to other militia members read in part, quote, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war. Prepare your mind, body, spirit. It will be a bloody and desperate fight." Rhodes is a former U.S. Army paratrooper. Meanwhile, the House committee investigating the January 6th riot has subpoenaed officials at four social media companies, YouTube, Facebook, and Reddit, and Twitter, saying they contributed to the spread of misinformation that led to the insurrection. The Republican National Committee is threatening to prevent future candidates from participating in presidential debates, accusing the commission, which oversees the process, of bias. Jamie Harrison, chair of the Democratic National Committee, tweeted in response, quote, "Republicans can't win a fair fight, and they know it." UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has made an impassioned plea for the U.S. and the World Bank to release billions of dollars of Afghan assets that were frozen after the Taliban takeover in August. Guterres warned Thursday Afghanistan faces economic and social collapse, with some 8.7 million Afghans now teetering on the brink of starvation. He also called on the international community to step up and fund the U.N.'s $5 billion humanitarian appeal.
"Freezing temperatures and frozen assets are a lethal combination for the people of Afghanistan. Rules and conditions that prevent money from being used to save lives and the economy must be suspended in this emergency situation. International funding should be allowed to pay the salaries of public sector workers and to help Afghan institutions deliver healthcare, education, and other vital services."
We'll have more on the crisis in Afghanistan after headlines. Tensions over Russia's military buildup on the Ukraine border remain high after a week of diplomatic talks failed to achieve any concrete resolution to the crisis and to Russia's demands that NATO curb its eastward expansion. Russia said Friday it's giving the U.S. and NATO until next week to respond to its demands. On Thursday, Russia's deputy foreign minister suggested its military could deploy to Venezuela and Cuba in response to escalating tensions with the U.S. Meanwhile, Russian-led troops have started withdrawing from Kazakhstan. A violent crackdown on protests this month killed at least 160 protesters and saw some 10,000 others arrested. Queen Elizabeth has stripped British royal Prince Andrew of his military titles and royal patronages amidst the ongoing sex assault case against him. Earlier this week, a U.S. judge ruled the sex abuse lawsuit against Andrew can proceed after his lawyers tried to get it dismissed, citing a deal between the plaintiff, Virginia Giuffre, and Jeffrey Epstein. Giuffre has accused Prince Andrew of raping her when she was 17 years old. Australian immigration authorities have for a second time revoked a visa for Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic, who has refused to be vaccinated against COVID-19. This comes just 3 days before the start of the Australian Open tennis tournament. An investigation found Djokovic provided false information on the documents he gave to border officials during his entry to Australia last week. He's appealing the decision. Visit our website, democracynow.org, to see our coverage of the plight of refugees in the same immigration detention center in Australia where Djokovic was initially held. New climate data show 2021 was the sixth hottest year on record, with global temperatures rising about 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. This is NOAA, that's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration scientist Russell Vose.
The last 7 years have been warmer than anything we've seen before. They really sort of stand out. Each of the past four decades has been warmer than the decade that preceded it. It's been a steady increase in temperature since at least the 1960s and really since the late 19th century.
At least 25 countries set new annual temperature records last year. Here in New York City, several protesters were arrested Thursday for blocking traffic during a climate rally demanding Governor Kathy Hochul and state lawmakers take action to avert climate catastrophe. Protesters are demanding passage of the New York Build Public Renewables Act. The legislation would combat environmental racism, require the New York Power Authority to provide only renewable energy and power to customers, and would create tens of thousands of green union jobs. It's been over 3 years since New York lawmakers last approved a major climate bill. And New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy has postponed a key vote on a contract to build a $180 million gas-fired power plant in Newark. Murphy called for a more thorough environmental justice review and robust public engagement process. The governor's decision is being celebrated by community organizers in Newark's Ironbound neighborhood, who warn the power plant would worsen the already poor local air quality and exacerbate the climate crisis. Organizer Maria Lopez Nunez spoke on Democracy Now! Earlier this week.
In our communities, majority Black and Latinx, working class, immigrant community, that's deeply affected by the issues. And despite all of our socioeconomic issues, immigration issues, housing issues, we still fight to make sure that we're bettering our neighborhood. You know, we helped build a park along that river. We have a vision for our community, and that's all we're asking for. It's not anything extra. We're just asking for a chance to fight for clean air and clean water.
To see the rest of her interview, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we pass the grim milestone of 20 years of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, even Michael Leonard, the Marine general who set the place up, calls for it to close, says it should not have opened, that it's an affront to U.S. values. And yet, here we are. The number of Muslim men and boys imprisoned at Guantanamo has shrunk from some 800 to 39. That's meaningful. But I read an offhand reference to those men as awaiting justice. And while it's just language, one wonders, what do reporters imagine justice might mean to people charged with no crime, deprived of liberty unlawfully for decades, in a place designed to keep them from accessing justice and to keep anyone else from hearing about them, much less questioning the processes that put them there? We are a long way from understanding the full meaning of Guantanamo, but we can get the remaining detainees out. Our guest says that's something that can happen and should happen now. Pardis Kebriay is senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. She'll join us to talk about how closing Guantanamo is not everything we can do, but it is something we can do, and we should. But first, we'll take a look back at some recent press. Harvard Law Professor Guinier dies at 71. Known for civil rights work, public service. That was the headline on the Boston Globe's January 8th obituary for teacher, voting rights advocate, and author Lonnie Guinier. The story cited Harvard Law School Dean John Manning saying that Guinier changed our understanding of democracy, of why and how the voices of the historically underrepresented must be heard, and what it takes to have a meaningful right to vote. New York's Daily News had Lonnie Guinier, civil rights attorney, voting rights advocate, dies at 71. In big national media, it was different. The New York Times story was headlined, Lonnie Guinier, legal scholar at the center of controversy, dies at 71. While the Washington Post went with Lonnie Guinier, law professor and embattled Justice Department nominee, dies at 71. For some elite media, what's most important about an event, a country, or a human being is whatever those media have chosen to center, generally just the relationship to official power that for them is the source of all meaning. In Guinier's case, it's the fact that she was nominated by Bill Clinton to lead the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, but when conservative activists, upset about Supreme Court fights over Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas, campaigned to attack her nomination by transparently distorting her opinions, Clinton dropped her like a hot rock. That's the takeaway from Guinier's life and work. That corporate media center their own perspective doesn't mean that they acknowledge their own role. No, the Times can report that Republican assertions that Guinier championed affirmative action quotas were baseless, and that many of her criticisms around, for example, redistricting have since become mainstream. But don't expect them to remind that on the day her nomination was withdrawn, the Times ran an op-ed premised entirely on the false idea that she was in favor of, quote, segregating black voters in black majority districts, close quote, or that when the paper finally devoted an article to her actual views rather than to the political firestorm that raged around them, after the nomination had already been killed, there was still not a single quote from any of her writings. Quote, almost everyone is relying on reconstructions by journalists and partisans, injecting further distortions into the process, close quote. That was reporter David Margolick, and he acknowledged in an interview with Fair that everyone included himself. The Washington Post can talk about how conservative activists seized on articles whose actual content they neglected to cite in order to discredit Guinier, without even pretending to explore how some of their own leading lights, like Lally Weymouth, had attacked Guinier's support for affirmative action in the paper while advancing their own support for protection for racial minorities in South Africa. Well, it's okay now to acknowledge that South African apartheid was bad. At least reading corporate media's obituaries of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, that's what you'd be given to understand. As Ari Paul noted for Fair.org, Establishment Press celebrated Tutu, who died in late December, as not just a key leader against apartheid in his own country, but as a global advocate against oppression, including being a fierce Christian voice against homophobia. Still, the public was instructed not to remember outside of official lines. Many obituaries underplayed or utterly ignored that Tutu, as a South African crusader against apartheid, helped to normalize the idea that Palestinians suffered under a similar apartheid system. The New York Times obituary reduced Tutu's Palestine advocacy to one incident in 2010 when he unsuccessfully urged a touring Cape Town opera company to not perform in the country, while the AP ignored the issue entirely, as did obituaries in USA Today, the BBC, and NPR. Skating over Tutu's outspokenness about Palestinian rights in his official obituaries does a disservice to Tutu's life, as his intense advocacy for Palestinians was a major part of his devotion to social justice. And like all campaigns for social justice, it inspired reactionary pushback from defenders of the status quo, and some worse, like Donald Trump, Harvey Weinstein, and Jeffrey Epstein lawyer Alan Dershowitz, who was given time on Fox News to try to remind the world that Desmond Tutu was a rampant anti-Semite and bigot. Underplaying this aspect of Tutu's life understates his impact and reminds us of how scared many corporate media institutions still are of even broaching the issue of Palestinian human rights. Finally, when she was asked on Good Morning America about encouraging headlines that we're talking about this morning, this new study showing just how well vaccines are working to prevent severe illness, the Centers for Disease Control Director Rochelle Walensky responded, quote, "The overwhelming number of deaths, over 75%, occurred in people who had at least four comorbidities. So really, these are people who were unwell to begin with. And yes, really encouraging news in the context of Omicron. This means not only just to get your primary series, but to get your booster series. And yes, we're really encouraged by these results." Close quote. As the hashtag #MyDisabledLifeIsWorthSaving began trending on Twitter, disability activists like Adi Barkin were asking, are our deaths less tragic? Are our lives less valuable? Are we less human? Well, because they were picked up by right-wingers as proof that COVID concerns were overblown, media outlets like CNN went into fact-check mode to explain that Walensky's comments had been distorted and taken out of context. Crucial seconds were missing from the tape, you see, which would clarify that Walensky was referring specifically to the results of a study that found that a majority of deaths among the vaccinated involved comorbidities, not deaths overall. The subtext seemed to be that it's a very confusing time and just maybe some people might be looking for something to be offended by. Yeah, no. Information may be unclear, may shift with time, but priorities and attitudes remain. And those reflected in the statement that within whatever subgroup, fatalities affecting primarily those with comorbidities or pre-existing health issues are good news is disturbing. For what it's worth, some of the things the CDC defines as comorbidities, diabetes, high blood pressure, Down syndrome, cystic fibrosis, obesity, pregnancy, and asthma. Susan Henderson of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund didn't misunderstand the context of Walensky's comments. She wrote in an open letter that the message from the CDC was not only abhorrent, It perpetuates widely and wrongly held perceptions that disabled people have a worse quality of life than non-disabled people and our lives are more expendable. When physicians hold these beliefs, Henderson wrote, and they do, she cites a source, the outcomes for disabled people, especially during a pandemic such as we are living through, can be fatal. Messages from the head of the CDC must convey that all lives are valuable, and the loss of any life from COVID-19, whether it is the life of a person with a disability, an older adult, or a 32-year-old with no known disabilities, is a tragedy. As Barkin said, we live in the wealthiest country in history. We can afford to give health care to everyone. We can afford enough masks, tests, and medical staff to keep everyone safe. But that requires seeing the full humanity of each of us. News media could aid that effort if they would set aside the frame of back-and-forth political gotchas and assume the value of all human beings and our right to live full lives as not a talking point, but a premise. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. On January 10th, Associated Press's Today in History feature highlighted January 10th, 2002, when it said, quote, Marines began flying hundreds of Al-Qaeda prisoners in Afghanistan to a U.S. base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, close quote. 20 years on from the opening of that monument to the lawlessness and cruelty and racism of the U.S. after September 11, 2001, and media are still shorthanding Guantanamo detainees as Al-Qaeda prisoners. A bigger problem is U.S. news media's erratic attention to the continued operation of a military prison specifically designed to be beyond the reach of U.S. law, holding only Muslim men and boys, most of whom were never charged with anything, much less convicted. Even after the official end of the war on Afghanistan, the sense one gets of Guantanamo from the press is that it's lamentable, yet somehow unchangeable. Outrageous, yet somehow acceptable. Keeping it out of the U.S. public sight and mind was part of government's plan for Guantanamo. Some people have been resisting that effort, along with defending detainees' rights, for many years now, including our guest. Pardis Kebriai is senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Pardis Kebriai.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Well, around January 11th, the official 20-year mark, people may have seen headlines that a U.S. government review panel has approved the release of five men from Guantanamo. That sounds like motion, like movement. Many people, I think, may not understand the tremendous, maybe unbridgeable, gulf between approved for release and leaving Guantanamo.
I mean, it is a very good thing that those men have been cleared. They should have been cleared or probably could have been cleared years ago. But under the Trump administration for 4 years, there was just very little movement of any kind on Guantanamo. So things are finally picking up again this year under the Biden administration. But yes, there's a very big distance between being approved for transfer, which means basically that every government agency with a stake in these detentions has looked at its case files on these men, heard from them, and determined that their detention is not necessary. That's significant, obviously, but there have been men who were cleared for release years ago under the Obama administration who are still sitting in Guantanamo. So yeah, the work right now is to transfer those men out for the government to find countries for them to be sent to, either send them home, and in some cases they can be sent home, or to find third resettlement countries for them, and then to continue this process, which is underway, of approving for transfer the men who remain. At this point, 20 years on from 9/11, those processes really shouldn't be necessary. A certain number of detainees at Guantanamo, the majority who have never been charged and will never be charged, by the government. The government has had 20 years to determine whether it's going to bring charges against them, and it has not. So more than half of the men at Guantanamo are in that category. Administrative review processes really at this point should not be necessary for the government to decide, determine that continuing detention into year 21, 22 and on is not necessary, but that is the process it's undertaking, and it just needs to continue it and finish it and begin the work of transferring men out now. I mean, it is, as you've said and as I've said, 20 years, two decades of detention, and it needs to end.
Well, just for clarity, these men have to be transferred to other countries. I mean, it seems to me, if you just think about it, people who've been held without charge for decades now have been declared not to be a threat. Why are we still in charge of where they live afterwards? You know, what are these rules that govern where they can go, and why can't they come to the U.S.?
Well, by law, there's a ban on transferring them to certain countries and certainly to bringing them to the United States for any reason, even for prosecution. So there are legal obstacles that the United States Congress has erected to where they can go. But despite those obstacles, I mean, those have existed for a long time, and transfers have happened by the dozens before. Today, we're talking about a very small number of people who remain in Guantanamo. It's actually, for as many ways that we can lament the fact that it still exists, I've been reflecting on how remarkable it actually is where we are, which is from a population of nearly 800 in, you know, the early 2000s, when the early years of the prison, to 39 men today. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's remarkable, and that's the work of pressure, the work of organizers, journalists, advocates, lawyers, the men themselves, really in surviving this long. I mean, it's not the usual trajectory for prisons to empty, and it has. So today we're talking about very small number of people, and again, nearly half of whom have been approved for transfer by the United States itself. So this is not, at this point, insurmountable work. It can be done. Third countries need to be found in many cases, or people can just be repatriated. But that's work that has happened before and can happen again. Today, I think it's just a matter of, as usual, a bit of politics and will and whether and how to make this a real priority for the Biden administration, admittedly in the middle of a lot of crisis,
right?
I mean, there's context here, and I think everyone understands that. But that can't continue to delay the work of finally shutting the prison down. It can be done, and it needs to happen. It, you know, 20 years is enough. It's been enough for a long time.
Well, is there a real disagreement? Because we see some finger pointing that Congress is what's holding it up, that if Biden would just act, something could happen. What is behind the inertia, or who really does have the power? Does it require a multi-part effort?
No, it really doesn't, I think. I mean, this is work that can reside in the Biden administration. It's largely the work of quickly continuing to approve people for transfer if that's the process the administration feels it needs to undertake, although lawyers have said for a long time that at this point, 20 years on, for the men, the government has never charged and has no intention of charging. It really needs no further process.
Right.
Sort of speaks for itself that they remain uncharged and in this category for 20 years. But anyway, for the government to complete its review process, if that's what it's doing, and to find third countries or repatriate the people that it is clearing, that's work that can happen by the administration, by the State Department. I think the reason it has not is, frankly, a matter of getting their bearings internally and, you know, a lot of crisis, frankly, and chaos that I think the Biden administration inherited. But I think there's wide acknowledgement and understanding that now is the time to finally finish the work of closing the prison and that it can be done. It's just a matter of doing it. And there are right now 18 men who are sitting in Guantanamo, have been there for decades, and are approved for transfer. Third countries can be found for those men, need to be found for those men. There are countries the government sent people to by the dozens under the Obama administration. People could be transferred in a couple of transfers. I mean, there were, you know, dozens of people sent to Oman, to Saudi Arabia, to other countries in the past, and the same can be done. It doesn't necessarily have to be a matter of finding individual placements for every single person. That said, I think one lesson of transfers in the past is that real care needs to be taken also with where people are resettled and the conditions in which they land and the support they have. I mean, these are people who've been treated brutally in all the ways that we know and have been documented and need real support in order to recover, I don't know, but just to reintegrate. So care needs to be taken, but it can be done. I mean, the government has transferred dozens of people to countries before, and the same can be done now. So it's really just work that can largely reside in the administration, in the Biden administration, and it's just a matter of doing it now.
Well, we may, if that action is taken, we'll be hearing at some point about the lesson, about what we learned from Guantanamo, about what it meant. And I think many listeners, particularly younger listeners, may not have a real sense of the unprecedented nature and just the science fiction-y nature of Guantanamo. So if we could just return briefly to that first principle, the fact that it was put not on U.S. soil, not just to kind of keep reporters from being too inclined to investigate it, though the hurdles for journalists have always been high, but there was an idea that if the U.S. was holding foreigners outside of the U.S., that U.S. courts couldn't do anything about it. I mean, when we talk about this aura of lawlessness, that was built in and intentional.
That's right. You know, it is true that there have been a lot of things about Guantanamo that are particular. The remote nature of it, the really overt way that in the beginning the Bush administration denied people any even theoretical rights, the really overt kinds of torture that happened and were talked about in terms of methods. So there are certainly things that were very overt and brutal and particular to Guantanamo. And at the same time, I think anyone who has been exposed to or in or touched the criminal legal system in the United States or prison in the United States knows torture is not unique to Guantanamo. Prolonged detention is not unique to Guantanamo. The lack of due process is not unique to Guantanamo. And so I've sort of resisted, and a lot of us doing this work, advocates, lawyers alike, have resisted this notion that Guantanamo is exceptional. Mm-hmm. I think what has made it exceptional is the way that all these things that we do in the United States by the thousands and the millions and historically sort of came together in this particular way, in this particular prison, and in this particular time against this group of people. So I like to say it is very particular, but not exceptional. And that doesn't take away at all from the brutality of what people have been through and the harm of it, and that it's wrong and depraved at Guantanamo as it is in prisons in the United States, that have really resisted this idea of exceptionalism. And I think that's not a new idea. I think there have been a lot of us organizers and advocates, like I was saying, who understand that now and who have the broader context for the way that we treat and punish people we deem to be threats in some form. But we can hold both to say that it isn't exceptional and it's depraved and it needs to end and it matters. It doesn't matter more than the imprisonment of a client I have in the United States who's serving a life without parole sentence in Pennsylvania State Prison. But it matters as well. It's not, but.
Yeah. And finally, as with the deeper problems with the criminal legal system in this country, it seems to sometimes be missed in reporting that Guantanamo harmed and harms not only the people trapped there, you know, but the system within it operates, the rule of law. You know, if those things aren't jokes to us, then this is a concern for everyone and not simply a story about some hundreds of unfortunate men.
Absolutely. And I've reflected on this more recently, just sort of the circles of harm. I mean, it harms us in terms of law and democracy and human rights and all of that. And I don't mean to sort of be dismissive about those things. Those matter. But on a human level, there are circles of harm around this prison, as there are around every prison in America. You know, I think about the men that I have met and represent, a man who's still there 20 years on, his name is Sharkawi Al-Haj, he's 47, he's from Yemen. And we could talk about the particular cruelty of his experience in Guantanamo today, not knowing, still not knowing whether and when he might be released or if he's going to die there. So there's something, like I've said, very particular about the indefinite nature of detention. But it's not just him. It's his family. It's that circle of people. It's his family. It's people at Guantanamo, the staff, the guards who've had to guard the prison, and the medical staff who've had to follow orders to force feed hunger-striking detainees, and advocates who have traveled down to the base for years and had to sit across from people who've suffered torture. There are reverberations of all these things. And so, yes, it's more than just the individual inside. There's a whole world of people on the outside who are affected and carry the pain and trauma of Guantanamo. And that's part of why it's so important to remove these sites from the landscape.
We've been speaking with Pardis Kebriay, a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can follow their work online at ccr-justice.org. Pardis Kebriay, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Used to walk in the shade with my Well, good afternoon, listeners. Coming up in about a quarter an hour, we will be having John Grant on and his ubiquitous New York Times. It's out here now. Even us podunk Kansans have a glimpse into the New York Times via John Grant. In the meantime, we'll have a short musical interlude. Dig it up if you threaten me. Oh, man, that's been something else. I mean, the weather out here, we're setting up ourselves for single degree temperatures the next two mornings and three maybe. Mornings, cold, cold mornings. We're talking like 5 degrees. Boy, perfect weather for old-time music and news, huh? Drivers out there on the road. Man, that's tough stuff. Tough stuff, man. Well, I hope you enjoy the stuff. We can't finish off this set before John Grant without playing some Count Basie. Very popular in Kansas City back in the day. Should we have a commercial? No, we don't get paid for anything. we'll have to get to John Grant here after this. Let's see what we got here for. Oh, here is an outrageous thing that came up in the Abolitionist Hour a couple Saturday nights ago. If you haven't listened to the Abolitionist Hour here on RFK, you might be missing something here. Here's a little short one.
As we come marching in the beauty. Heaven runs through my veins.
Saturday night show, the Abolitionist Hour here on RFK. He was on there, and I was trying to get John in the green room before the song was over with, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't get the network to move me quick enough, And I was, it's terrible. I want you to listen to that later on. We got John Grant, man. He's coming on here. Hold on. John?
Oh yeah, it definitely does it for me.
I mean, it sort of
well, here we are, the northeast Kansas, southeast Pennsylvania hookup here. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And I'm baking. I'm baking and I'm baked, both all at the same time.
I'm baking
some cornbread, getting ready for the cold weather, my head is baked, man, ready for the show.
Oh, I like being baked, but I like cornbread, too. I am a total fan of cornbread. Yeah. It's comfort food on a cold day, man, a nice piece of cornbread.
Well, beans.
Beans,
oh, yeah. We're preparing for 5-degree lows for the next two mornings.
We're pretty good here. We had like half a dozen flakes of snow, and it was pathetic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we don't have any. It's cold, but it's not that cold.
Temperature? What is it?
I don't know. It's probably in the 40s. It's not freezing. You know.
Oh God, I don't want to hear. We're 55, and this is what's crazy. We're 55 today. And we've got probably a half foot of snow in the last 2 days. So the snow is melting off. It's going to be 55 degrees today. And then tomorrow we begin the plunge. And by, Thursday morning, it's supposed to be 5 degrees in the morning for the next two or three days after that. That's weird.
Ouch.
Crazy weather.
Ouch. 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 Yeah.
So did you get the... did you get the New York Times? You were telling me.
I got it. I'm looking. Of course, the center photograph is a march for voting rights, of course, featuring the children and grandchildren of Martin Luther King. They seem to think that we need to work on our democracy in America. I don't know why they think that, but... Martin Luther King Day, and democracy is in the air. Talks about the synagogue. In Dallas, the synagogue that was held hostage by the fellow.
That guy wasn't even an American citizen, was he?
No. He was a Middle Eastern, quote, terrorist. I guess that's what they're sloughing him off as. But he came from Britain.
BBC is reported, and I've seen it. This guy is a British. He was born in England.
Right, exactly. He's a British citizen.
Now, for the English people, the English readers that there are the seems to be. How did he arrive? He left England just a few, like a couple weeks or so ago, and he already he gets a gun in America.
I
that's
know.
The biggest thing
go
in
figure.
England.
This is America, you know. Hey, gun. You know, but
how did he get a fucking gun?
I don't know. That's what they got to find out. But anyway, he ends up in Dallas at a you know synagogue, and the rabbi, of course, this synagogue, because of previous assaults, has been training itself for exactly this kind of thing. And so,
good for them.
The you know they talked to the guy. They you know they harangued him, and you know they were trying to. Talk to him and so he wouldn't blow up or anything. At the same time, the rabbi was looking at the door and he was sort of indicating, you know, get as close to the door as you can. And, you know, he was looking at all the features in the room, like chairs and desks and tables of what to do. And at the opportune time, he picked up a chair, some kind of fucking chair, and threw it at this son of a bitch, and it said, everybody run, you know? And, you know, they smashed him, and I guess with the chair, and he did, you know, and they all got out of there, and I guess, I don't know whether the guy shot himself or they shot him, I'm not sure. But, you know, it was one of those cases where you know, this idea of, you know, when the shit hits the fan, you're on your own here. And, you know, be resourceful. And the rabbi came through. You know, he didn't piss and moan or beg, or he picked up a chair and smashed it in the guy's face. And, you know, they got out alive. And, you know, this is a modern response. I think we have to, you know, train ourselves to be resourceful and do that kind of thing. So it's an interesting story in itself, you know.
Yeah, he you know, I was impressed when I read the BBC version of that.
Yeah.
I'm not impressed with the New York Times. I'm because one of the things they're all the stories that I'm getting and they're abbreviated headline a little more than headlines, even at BBC. It was like a 4 hour plus standoff. It lasted a long time. Did the guy shoot himself or did he try to shoot the cops?
I'm still a little unclear.
Or, I mean,
In fact, to be fair, I haven't read entire articles, so I don't know. So I'll have to figure that one out. But now, Putin, Vladimir Putin, of course, is a steady diet on the front page these days. He's rattling sabers on the border with Ukraine, and he's thinning out his embassy in Kiev, which is another thing alarming people. You know what? He's thinning out his embassy. Does it mean he's ready to invade? So he's strutting around doing Vladimir Putin provocative things, and. And the worries in China, the birth rate is falling. You know, they apparently people are not having children. They limited them to one child for a while. But now, I guess the economy is so good that a lot of people are saying, well, hell, I don't even want one goddamn child, you know, and I'm just going to enjoy this good economy. So now all of a sudden, you know, China has flipped around. It's now concerned that its birth rate is falling. Well, you wanted the birth rate to fall. You even had a national policy of one child, and you know. So it's interesting. So China's going through.
Those are statistics, John. I gotta throw this in. Statistics, and you know that could be a 2 year delay in this finding. I mean, come on, people can screw like rabbits, you know, drop kids
that's
out right
true.
And left.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
No, I'm just giving a smattering of the front page and what it suggests of movements and things, wrigglings going on in the world, you know.
I understand, of course, the
historic Miami Beach Deauville Hotel, which I'm always aware of because I was from down there, the Deauville, one of the fancy original hotels, it's now a wreck. it's falling prey to neglect and time, and it's a mess, and they're going to have to knock it down, I guess. And that's a big deal in Miami Beach. So, anyway, that's the front page. Miami Beach.
Well, that, you know, I got to tell you, that's the edit. That's an editor's decision there to put that Miami Beach hotel on the front page.
Well, that's sort
if
of a cultural story, almost, in a way. You know, I mean, Miami is going through lots of changes, like, you know, the moon tides, the water floods on the streets. They had to elevate the main street in Miami Beach, I think. They millions and millions of dollars to elevate it so it doesn't flood during the moon tides every month. And, you know, this is Florida. This is the wonderful state of Florida is now having, you know, like everybody.
Miami.
Problems. This is Miami. Yeah, of course. I was when I was in high school. I was in high school almost on the Keys, down in Homestead, and it was 20 miles north. Yeah. Was Miami, Miami Beach, and all that. Well, by the time I got to 12th grade, I was a surfer. You know, I could hang
really?
Five. I could stick my five toes off the. We used to go to surf on. We would skip school. And go to surf on Miami Beach, the government cut, which is a famous cut there with a pier, and, wow. And the surf was kind of good there. And so we would go there, and here's the deal. This is my 12th grade. We'd figured out that there are these forms you had to fill out if you had an absence. And you bring your note from your mother, your doctor, whatever, to the office, and then they give you this form, and you go around, and each teacher in your six periods would check it off, and then you turn it back in, right? Well, what we did was we skipped school. Somebody stole a bunch of these forms, right? And we had a contest as to who could sign Dean Harris's signature the best, right? And I won. C.A. Harris, I could do his scribble. I could do it pretty good. You know? So we got like, you know, 50 of these things, and I signed every goddamn one of them. And then the people, if we skipped school, we'd give them one of these. And they'd go around and have all their six teachers sign it, and then they'd throw it away, and nobody knew the difference, you know? And it was like, and God, we skipped school a lot. I used to go, wow, let's go surfing today. Okay, then, but, you know, 15 of us would go up and go surfing. And so, yeah, that was my experience with Miami Beach. We would go and surf for the day and hot, and there was a bagel factory. This is Miami Beach, of course, which the,
yeah.
You know, the,
yeah.
A lot of bagels in Miami Beach. Well, there was a bagel factory, and we'd go to this after all this surfing and, you know, the air and the sea and the salt, we would go and at the side door buy some, right off the bakery oven, we'd get these warm bagels, and it was like,
yeah,
wow, that was just, yeah. It was just wonderful. Yes,
rock salt and mustard.
Yeah, there. Well, this is yeah. Well, that's pretzels. You're thinking of pretzels, which is a very close to a bagel. Yeah, it's somewhat similar to a bagel.
I met this dame. Well, woman, whatever, from Pennsylvania, and she served, you know, soft, warm pretzels with rock
delicious.
salt on them, and mustard.
You
and
got
mustard.
It.
There's
it,
no beef.
It's Philadelphia's specialty.
Don't lie
right?
to me.
I'm not
yeah,
lying
you
to you. What are you talking about? You accuse me
well,
of
lying? I guess, is there a different? Well,
you know, I'm a pretzel man. I love a warm pretzel.
Now, listen. Don't you know that Kansas don't know the difference between bagels and pretzels?
Well, that's what I'm trying to explain to people out in Kansas. You know, the difference between a soft pretzel and a bagel. It's probably something to do with thickness, you know. Think of a pretzel as just a circle, but very thick. That's like a bagel. But if you thin it down and you have it like a shape like a, you know, like a Rheingold ad or, you know, Rheingold label there, you know, it's a pretzel. But they do have similarities. The nuances.
You were buying these nice bagels or pretzels, whatever they may be.
Right. These were bagels.
Soft bread. While you were eyeballing
warm. I mean, they were warm.
You were eyeballing flesh.
Uh-huh.
After eyeballing flesh.
Oh, well, of course, the girls, yeah. We always had girls there. There were some pretty raunchy escapades, I know, on the beach. And it was the talk of the town when we got back to school. Oh, my God, what happened on the beach? You know, there were these. I remember one time. I wasn't lucky enough because I was kind of just an ordinary schmuck, but there were, of course, the celebrity jocks and the kids. And then there were these very loose young ladies who appeared on the beach one day, and it's like they were there for business, you know, and only the cool guys got to hide out and you know, as you said, copulate and all that stuff, you know. But those were the teenage days, you know, living in redneck South Dade County and going up and surfing on Miami Beach. And, you know.
The only thing I know about Miami Beach is way out of my ballway. Closest I ever got was Pensacola for a summer. And
well, Pensacola
is
on the other end of the goddamn place,
Yeah, I know. It's cocaine. I mean, it's just cowboys, Cubans. I mean, you know, it's all.
Oh yeah,
that's
cocaine.
All I know about Miami.
Miami Vice, of course.
How did you pick? How did you guys pick the beach? How did you know they weren't going to?
Well,
they
picked the beach because, as they say, this is government cut. Government cut was a cut that came, you know, brought into the bay, or not bay, but into the harbor. What is a harbor? What, the Miami River and all that kind of shit. But anyway, it was a cut that was dug out, and boats and ships could come in. And at that point, I don't know why, just the configuration, geological configuration of it, that there was a big pier there, and the surf was pretty good. You know, you could paddle out and you know, get a good ride, and you know, hey, surfing, man, that was a thing. You know?
So it was by a pier, was it? But it wasn't.
Yeah,
there was a pier,
and you know, if you really had balls, you could shoot the pier. You know, I didn't have the balls to do that, but you know, to take a ride into the pier and go through the pier.
Oh God!
Shoot the pier.
Suicide.
suicide march. You know? I just wanted to surf, do some, you know, I couldn't hang 10, that was a little much, but I could hang 5, which means sticking 5 toes off the front of the board, which, you know, you have to get a pretty good wave to hold you up to get a, you know, stick 5 toes off the front.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And, so I was kind of a, you know, for being a loser and a nerd, I guess, I was a cool guy there for just a bit, you know.
Right. Hey, you know, it was years and years ago when I was in Pennsylvania. I was a young man, 16, so I don't know what it would be. My God. Anyhow, the beaches were still segregated, more or less, I guess, at certain times. What was Miami Beach? Were there beaches?
Well,
I was there in Pensacola.
I moved there in 1958.
Oh, shit.
What?
So the beach was segregated.
Well, I don't remember any black people on the beaches that I was surfing at in 1960. Frankly, so yeah, I you know, but this is the trouble with the, you know, this is the problem. You know, I was, and this is why I'm thinking of writing a memoir about that whole episode in my life. It's a short period, but a profound period, where I was moved from, you know, liberal suburban New York bedroom community out of New York City in a house with literally pillars on the front, like Mount Vernon. And my father lost his mind and moved the family down to redneck South Dade County across from tomato fields and avocado groves into this concrete block shack that had been owned by two hermit brothers out in the, you know, in rural area just before the Keys. Then we built an addition on it, but it was quite a shock, you know. And I tried to figure out, you know, basically as a 10-year-old in redneck, Redlands Junior High School, job was to hang back like a fly on the wall and say, what the fuck is going on here, you know? And so I developed this kind of, I think, detached journalistic mode that my job was to figure out what was going on, you know, because this is all new, you know. And I used to get in, you know, bullies would, you know, and I finally dealt with the bullies. I learned how to deal with the bullies. You jump all over them, you know. You don't let them bully you. You smack the hell out of them, and then they decide, well, I don't want to fuck with this guy anymore. I'm going to fuck with somebody else. And, you know, that was – so I learned a lot in redneck South Dade County. I learned how to get around the dean, who I like, Dean Harris, a wonderful man. I signed his name. No, but I really like Dean Harris. He suspended me once for 2 weeks for smoking in the boys' room, you know. And but I still didn't hold it against him. He was a very decent man. So anyway, whatever. This is my childhood, you know.
Yeah, I understand. I think it's relevant. I mean, you're reading the New York Times to us and telling us about the,
right.
You were there. You've been at Miami. You got a real feel for the thing.
Right. And of course, I landed in this place. A long established history of separate school systems. You know, so we didn't even see black people. I mean, they were,
right.
You know, really. I mean, it was
yeah,
white.
No, I know.
Yeah, and it's like you don't question it because this is the way it is. My mother had to explain to me the separate drinking fountains at the Winn-Dixie, and you don't ever drink from that one. Why? Oh, don't, no. Oh, you're not. No, don't go near that. You know, and. And, of course, I rebelled from a lot of that. I rebelled as much as I could as a pathetic teenager, you know. I picked limes in the summer with migrants and blacks and got to like them and joke with them and had fun with them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, my father, with a PhD who taught at the University of Miami Medical School in Miami, was a racist bigot, you know, and... you know, so I was, no, really, I mean, that's fact of life. I was out there hanging out
Did
with the black folks saying, yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I think you're being much too hard on the old man. Okay.
You knew him
intimately, as they say.
I was an adolescent, recalcitrant child. There's no question about that.
Right.
And I did make
my father's life
miserable. And, in fact, my great uncle, who was my father, loved this man. He was more than his father. My great uncle, Unc, was vice president of RCA during World War II. And he would come down to Florida, and this was – an event that our family looked forward to. We liked, whenever Unc would come down, we would drink and The first thing Unc wanted to do was go out and pee in the front lawn because we were in such a rural area that, you know,
right.
actually instead of the backyard, you could pee in the front yard, you know, and nobody.
Right.
And so we would all go out there with Unc, you know, my great uncle Unc.
Yeah.
And my father and the three boys, and we'd be all out urinating on the front lawn. And, you know, having drunk already, and, you know, I don't know, I probably nipped a little. Anyway, this was Unc, and Unc one day came to me in the backyard. I remember, I'll never forget it. He said, "John, why are you so hard on your father?" And I was like, "Wait a minute. Wait a minute, he's awful hard on me too, you know." And so that's kind of the way it went. But yeah, okay, fair enough. I was hard on the old man, yes. But listen, he was an educated PhD racist bigot. There's just no way around it.
Well, but he I'll bet you he never acted or spoke as frankly about his opinions on race and class and gender
mm-hmm.
as he did to you. He probably never talked like that when he was doing his job.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I, of course, at the end of his life, we made up and everything was cool. You know, I gave up. You know, I said, "What the hell am I going to do?" You know, I mean, he's my father. You know, and in fact, I don't know why we're on this sort of. But, you know, I'm going to write about this. The last thing the man ever said to me, I may have said this before, but the last thing he ever said to me was on the phone. And he was talking, he got to talking about black people in Naples, Florida, where he's living. And there was something about somebody in the neighborhood was hiring black people for phones or working, and it really annoyed him, you know. And as I, at that point, I would listen to him and give him rope, and I'd given up, you know. And he's going on and on about these black folks and this and that, and he realizes all of a sudden, oh my God, I'm speaking to my middle son. Wait a minute. And there's this Paul on the phone line, and he realizes kind of what he's been saying, I think. And of course, I haven't said a thing. And he says, "I'm not a racist, Paul. I just hate the bastards, you know." And
I might have said to him,
"Well, Dad, that is a bit of a nuance there, I guess, you know."
Yeah.
And then he died, you know.
Then he died. That's sad.
Then he died.
Did you know he was ill? We got a caller here with their hand up. Let's.
Well, hey, I didn't, you know, he died of a heart attack at 87, I think it was. So, you know, it's...
Oh, my God, that's a long
life. Yeah, that's a good fight. Yeah, what the hell. But,
yeah,
you know, as I say,
yeah.
I just want to be clear that I did, we did, make up. And at the end of our life, we were very, very close. And, you know, as I say, there was nothing I could do about
it. That's the way it was.
Yeah.
Fucking story of the generations, I'm telling you, man. Hey, we got a call with
absolutely.
Their hand up.
I'm gonna
put him
talk.
In without, you know, we don't screen that much. I don't screen that much usually.
Yeah, caller,
area code 602. You're on the air. There's several other callers.
Good morning,
read
the name of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Hold up. What?
Grieve the name of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I'm here.
Okay.
I'm alive.
Okay. All right,
go ahead. So
how you doing? Yes, you are. Yeah, I'm feeling great, man. I'm listening to y'all conversation. I had to call in because I want to be involved in the conversation too.
Good. Okay. So how do you want to factor in the conversation? What do you have to say?
I've been on over 1,000 of these radio shows. I've seen a lot of things, and the last 2 years have been crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So my mind is all open for whatever I have to interject.
Good. Okay. Your mind is open? Open to what?
Well, I believe that faith comes by hearing, and we can't teach the word of faith while not hearing other people going through problems and situations.
Hmm?
Yeah, for real.
right?
Yeah, you lost. I lost you. I got to circle back around and pick him back up.
What's that?
Yeah,
I got to circle back around and pick you back up.
Yeah, pick him back up, man. Pick John Grant back up.
Back up.
Come on, man.
What do you go by? What do you go by? What's your first name? Or what do you
Pastor Don Jr. CEO. Pastor Don Jr. CEO. You can Google me. I'm on like 5,000 social networks. I'm out there.
What part of the country do you come from?
I'm in Mesa, Arizona right now, but I live in 30 out of 56. So
okay,
I've been
Arizona.
Around.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I bet you have. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think we live in interesting times, and you know, I talk about my upbringing in South Dade County, Florida, because to me it's interesting in the formation of you know, me and but other people as well, and to the world we live in now, where you know a lot of these issues are popping up, and you know, race is a perennial issue, and. You know, and here we are in kind of crazy times.
I used to live in Florida. The first time I got married, I was in Florida. So I know a lot about Dade County.
What part? In Dade County? You're in Dade County?
No. I used to live there. I came to Gainesville, then I migrated to Jacksonville, to Tampa. I know Florida very well.
Good. Yeah, well, Florida's a wacky state, man, let me tell you.
Yes.
I have a real, real soft spot for Florida, but at the same time, I guess you'd call it a love-hate relationship, you know? I mean,
100%.
It's a very interesting state, and it's getting more and more interesting as things move on. Now, the governor, of course, is he's going kind of nose-to-nose, head-to-head with Donald Trump because...
Oh, wow.
Ron DeSantis just thinks he could be the presidential candidate in 2024. And, of course, Donald Trump still wants, you know, total loyalty from everybody. So there's this struggle going on between the governor of Florida and Donald Trump, who has, of course, located the Trumpian Republican Party in Florida. That's its home base, you know, Mar-a-Lago and whatnot. But so the Florida
Hey,
politics.
wait a minute, John.
Yeah.
John.
Yeah.
Hey, he said this guy was in Arizona. Donald
yeah, but he
Trump
said he
went,
lived
yeah,
in
yeah,
Florida.
No, no.
He said he lived in Florida a lot. Yeah.
Yes, yes, I stayed there.
Oh,
for
yeah, but I'm,
years,
no, this
I'm
guy, this guy said he was in Arizona. This guy said he was in Arizona, the caller, and
mm-hmm.
Trump was in Arizona this weekend.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Hard to keep up with the old orange hair there, you know. Yeah.
I've been all around the world, man. All around the world.
Now, have you been in the military? Have you been in the military?
No, sir. I've been in what they call is the radio business.
The radio biz?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to hear from you. And any other thoughts you have?
I want you to have a positive day, a blessing on your show. I'm a listener, but I wanted to press one so you could know that I'm here.
Well, I appreciate your call. I mean, it's good to hear from you. And life is interesting, and we have to, you know, be as positive as we can, you know, and have a good time, get some laughs, and, you know, life is good.
Yeah, and we've got several other callers, listeners. You can put by punching one on your dial, it'll put a little hand up on the switchboard and let me know you want to visit with John Grant. So, Miami. I mean, it's just sort of, all roads lead to Florida or somewhere down there. I mean,
well, in my life, certainly, as I say, I'm cooking up this memoir. Now, I realize when I look back at Florida, my Florida, it was 1958, I was 10 or 11, and we moved there. Uh-huh. And I left there essentially after graduating high school in 1965 and joined the United States Army. And so that was 1965. So as I look back, this whole incredible episode in my life was only like 7 years, you know. It wasn't all that much.
Uh-huh.
But it was such
a
critical juncture, you know, from age 10
yeah.
to 18, you know, and then it's going from Florida to, you know, the military in Vietnam and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. and so, you know, this sort of launching pad for me into adulthood and redneck South Dade County, Florida was, you know, pretty interesting sort of thing. You know, it's certainly interesting little thing.
Well,
like, how many people do you know that have been chased by an alligator? I mean, really?
One other guy, my brother, and it was in Florida.
Oh, your brother, Mark?
He was between times. I don't know how to be polite about it, but he found himself snorkeling and cleaning barnacles off of rich people's yachts and sailboats.
Right.
And he was doing that to make money because he was having hard times. He's lived in, he was
right.
not able to live in Florida, you know.
Gotcha, yeah.
He had to work.
Damn, you got to work,
yeah.
So he was chased by an alligator?
And he had this. Yeah, and there's alligators all in these what do you call intercoastal highways or something.
I used to swim in a drainage canal. There was a little alligator in there too.
They had a system worked out where the rich guy on top, who was paying Mark to clean the barnacles and whatever off his hull, Mark used a thing called a hoopah. It was a goddamn, basically it was an air mask with an air hose hooked to it.
Gotcha.
And he would go down and
clean the barnacle.
He told me. We might get him on. He had a snorkel too, but he mainly used the airline. And the rich guy upside, sitting upside, on top side, he would pull the oxygen hose to signal him when the alligators were coming.
God, geez. Well, that's, I'll have to compare notes with Mark about being chased by an alligator. Now, I was literally chased by an alligator. Yeah. I was, my buddy and I snuck into the monkey jungle. I mean, you know, the monkey jungle was a tourist trap about a mile from my house, you know, and on Hainland Mill Road. And, you know, I was 14, and we just, well, shit, we got to sneak in the back, you know. We put a board over the fence, and long story short, they would advertise that, you know, the monkeys are free, and you are caged. You know, they had a little caged area that people would walk through, you know. And so my buddy and I, we heard, the monkeys were looking at us like, oh, who are you, you know, and all this. Rah, rah, rah. And we could hear the tour coming, you know, you hear the microphone or whatever, and, oh, shit, we better hide. So we started to go down this ditch, right? And, my God, you know, I guess maybe 20, 30 feet away is like this 8-foot, fucking alligator, you know. It's like, holy shit. So we scrambled back up the ditch, and you know, because we're 14-year-old boys that had been so scared, the tour manager, at that point we forgot about the tour. We didn't even care about the tour. We just cared about getting away from the alligator, you know. And so because we're 14-year-old boys and we had been so scared, what did we do? We naturally had to throw rocks at him, you know. So we're up at the sort of halfway up the side of the ditch throwing rocks at this fucking alligator. And he literally jumped up onto his legs and roared and came at us shaking his ass, boy. And you never saw two teenage boys scramble and run so fast in your life. And, oh, God. I have an affectionate sort of thing with this alligator. I don't know.
No. I mean, I think there is something to it. For instance, my sweetheart, she was unceremoniously dumped in what it's something about culture shock affecting you at a certain time in your childhood. I said in your childhood,
exactly.
Development.
Yeah.
Because I mean, she was dumped from you might, I'm being euphemistic but accurate, literally from the Swiss Alps and France,
really?
And, Hyde Park of England.
Wow.
And at the tender age of like I think 10 or 12.
About the same time as me.
Dumped in the flat plains of the fucking worst part of Kansas.
Wow, and of course she's still there. Yeah, right, yeah, right.
Oh, no, yeah. What? No. Now she lives, we live in northeastern Kansas.
Oh, different part
totally
of Kansas.
Totally different.
Okay, right, gotcha.
Yeah. Oh, it's totally different. The
well, you know.
Yeah, we have a little bit.
Yeah.
But the point
as I was mentioning to you in the green room, I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry, my bad. Yeah.
Well, I just want to finish about the beloved, you know. It's a culture shock for her, and I think her driving motivation to later become a doctor and all that, all the things that she's made, things that she's done with her life, came from the rebellion from getting the fuck out of that environment to achieve, to get a college degree, get another college degree. To you know, take on that. Letting you know. I think it's a psychological thing of adolescence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like the wrong time to relocate for your old man. You know, I mean.
Well, yeah,
but for you,
it was a good time for him, I think. But you know, and I told him, you know, when we were making up, as he was getting older, and I remember I decided, what the hell, I'm just going to do it. You know, we had all this contention in my child life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wrote him this letter that just, you know, told him I loved him and all this, and I wanted him to know that this move to South Florida was just wonderful. I had such a wonderful upbringing there. You know, it was exciting. There's no question about it. So it wasn't traumatic. It was just, you know, disorienting and exciting.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to tell him that, hey, this is wonderful. I value these 7 years and all that stuff. And, you know, it knocked his socks off, and he sent me this letter back, you know. So we had this little moment where we sort of connected, and then of course,
right,
you know, he would revert to his worst at times, and, you know, he would say terrible things. He would get upset when the family got together, and dad, relax, calm down, yeah, geez, and
yeah,
you know it is.
People have, I just want to let you know they're out there. There is a cultural shock, I think. Take it from a...
Well, that's interesting, you know, coming from all these cosmopolitan places where you suggested your wife had, you know, been spawned or earlier experiences, and then, you know, ending up in some remote area of Kansas. You do develop this sort of hold back a little bit to see what's going on sort of mood, you know?
Yeah, and I think, right. Well, maybe we all share that. I mean, that's what I did. Cultural adversity in the little town I grew up at until I was like 18. Right. I mean, I was like, you know, the bull, you know, it was better to just sit back and watch the bullies than let the bullies come after you.
Yeah,
you know?
you learn eventually that, well, I mean, it's, you know, I think it's like the larger Munich principle, you know, with Hitler and all that. You know, you just can't appease people. And this is, frankly, if you want to look at this in a metaphorical sense, this is the way we should treat now domestic terrorists after the January 6th. You know, we treat them like bullies. You don't appease them at all. You just slam them as hard as you can. And whether our criminal justice system is capable of that is, of course, a good question.
Did
I lose you there? Or what?
Well, no, I mean, I'm just saying that it's the listeners. I'm trying to address the listeners. I mean, since we last talked with John, there was 12 less, I guess, people arrested over January 6th. Since then, there's been 12 more arrested, which are charged with a heinous charge, seditious conspiracy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll bet there's something in the Times about that, New York Times about that. I mean,
well, not today. There's been several in the past. Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal. You know, I think they charged the, in the 50s, the Puerto Rican macheteros, I think they called them, the machete guys, who went in and shot up the Congress. They wanted to liberate Puerto Rico, the colony of Puerto Rico, and to make it a free state. And they, broke into an active session of Congress and shot the place up. I think they wounded 17 congresspeople. This was in the 50s. They were charged with, in sedition and things like that. It's not a charge that's used a lot, so it's interesting they're using it.
I mean, that was news out here in terms of people. We've had a parade, a very short parade in Kansas, which is very rare because most people out here, they love to get at parades. It's sort of pathetic.
Of course.
100 people in a town and 90 of them participate in the parade and the other 10 watch. But we have a very short parade. 8 have been arrested in the state of Kansas. A few others in Missouri. I haven't kept count of them. But in Kansas, we had 8. And the woman that our brother Mark, doesn't know personally, but has been in her shop in Leavenworth. And the woman pled guilty, and I think she got, a real no-knock'em. It's like a 100 hours community service. She might be wearing an ankle bracelet for a couple years. I mean, it's basically, it's a pat on the hand. But she was sincerely contrite, considering she was not from this country.
Right.
She's from England.
Right. Right.
Well,
yeah, there you go.
That's what Mark says. I was visiting with him about that because she's in all the newspapers for the it's a very well written, sincere letter of remorse to the judge and then there's others like a couple out of Olathe who seem to be sort of, I'm surprised, I haven't checked the court documents. They might have been neck deep in the what's his name, Stuart Rhodes.
He's the head of the Oath Keepers, I think.
They're
the ones charged with sedition. They're the ones that were traipsing through in formation through the pack and all this, armored up kind of war gear that they were wearing that day. And, apparently they were intricately involved in some of this really nasty stuff. And so we'll see how it plays out. But I think the idea of bullying and things, applies to a lot of this stuff because I think, you have to sort of stretch it out a little bit and into the legal realm. But, the far right feels that it can bully its way into power, it seems to me, by intimidation, by threats of violence, by poo-pawing January. Oh, it was just like rambunctious tourists,
That's crazy.
Well, no, it wasn't, It was, you know, some of the people were obviously just, you know, along for the ride, and they didn't. But others were really pursuing something that it seems more and more the evidence is showing that from Trump on down, that these people were, without, you know, literally exposed, you know, making evidence of their doing. It was all like, you know, and sort of innuendo and codes and all this stuff to push this, you know, lying narrative that he'd really won the election and the Democrats were stealing it. You know, that, you know, to push that was, you know, this is the situation we're in anyway. You know, and bullying seems to me the way they're trying to do it. They certainly have given up on the idea of free democracy and electoral politics and all that.
Oh.
It's like if we, you know, I was watching this stupid, I turned it off, a Spanish movie on Netflix about a writer, a crime writer who turns out to be a killer. And somebody comes up to have his book signing, and she says to him, why do your people like to kill so much, you know? It was a lousy movie, so I ended up turning off. But his response was interesting. He finally said, she asked him a couple times, he finally said, he kills because he can. You know what I mean? And if, you know, if you can bully and you can, you know, overthrow and you can intimidate and use violence, and as Donald Trump said, I could kill somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, you know, that people do things, as this writer and killer said, because he can. You know, if you allow people to get away with things, they're going to do it. And so, you know, that's why, you know, I think the September or the January 6th hearings are going to come up with something, because they're going about it very slowly, too slow for my wife and everybody, me, you know. But, you know, I think we got to put the bullies down in this case. And I think it is a matter of bullying. Because a lot of I see identity politics, a lot of our victimization obsessions with identity politics and all, they're picking on us, you know, our group, is avoiding and actually exacerbating the problems, because the backlash becomes identity politics, white supremacy and all that, that the issue is one of, you know, related metaphorically to bullying. It's like, do you allow people, for instance, to lynch black people or to be, you know, unfair with black people, limit their electoral powers and their voting rights and all that kind of stuff, or, you know, you harass transgender people in schools and things like that.
Yeah.
That's not a identity politics issue. That is a bullying issue. That is an abusive issue of violence.
Yeah.
In other words,
well,
you know, so why, you know, I'm sorry.
Americans, it's all right. Americans have been fed this propaganda and salvos to the point it's reached their inner brain. I don't know. You know, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of their fight or flight. I mean, I think it's just Americans, mainly us, because we're so indoctrinated. I hate to say this, you know, but I think there's a lot of the patterns of indoctrination that's gotten where ignorance is strength and might makes right. I mean,
you got it.
You know, and I think people really just haven't addressed that yet, and they are being forced to address it.
Well, it's hard to address because you know, the problem now is, as I told my police department here, my township police department, which I engage in, I told the chief and the lieutenant, you know, if civil war comes, I'm not sure which side you guys are on. And I meant that. I like these guys, you know?
Yeah,
And I just don't know, you know, they're going to – I saw my friend get arrested at a demonstration in Westchester here when he was abused by the other side, and the cops were totally in bed with the right-wing pro-war guys, and then they continued to abuse him. They were – you know, it was just so crystal clear that the cops were simply, you know, politically on the other side. So, you know –
Well, almost every cop I ever met was considered themselves, if not Republicans, then conservatives.
Right.
Almost every cop.
And I understand that you know, policing is a conservative force. They're conserving. But this is why my wife is painting these pictures of these four cops that were testified before Congress at Capitol Police, right? She's got these great paintings of these guys. And point is, here these people, this is, you know, a woman, my wife, who is not particularly pro-cop, you know.
Right. But
these guys speak to her because they were actually doing police work against, you know, they had no choice because they were all over them, against these right-wingers that often are sympathetic with cops. And these guys, you know, are now ostracized by many people because they, you know, took on the right. And they didn't have much choice, of course. They were being assaulted.
And they did it in public.
You know,
I think it
raises a lot of very interesting questions.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
I agree. I think it's a good thing. I think fundamentally it's a good thing.
I too.
Do you think there's any truth? We only have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've only got about, that's a two-minute warning right there, John, flying by.
Oh, wow, that's a two-minute warning. it felt like a tsunami there or something. I didn't know.
That was the launch from here to the Ukraine on the border with Putin. Do you think there's any truth? That there was a hashtag. I couldn't find the report, but I've heard rumors that it was actually a good thing at January 6th that the Antifa and Black Lives Matter people, the opposition, did not show up in the streets to do combat with the Trump people. There was over 100,000 there. I mean,
But well, I
there was
that,
actually
that
a hashtag that says, well, there was a hashtag allegedly on Twitter that says, don't take the bait. Take the bait, and I think it was. I mean, it was very self-exposing on the reactionary character of these people. And there was any number of cops who probably were pretty. I can't prove it. Lackluster about their duties.
Yeah,
there were hundreds of others that weren't. But I mean, there was people that were cops. I mean, I'm sure that. But the dangerous thought behind this is that. I understand that the National Guard, the delay in bringing the National Guard on was not just the word optics. It was this thing that there was no opposition. You know what I mean? So why in the streets to the demonstrators, they couldn't go in and pick on, like you just said about your friend that was abused by the cops and he wasn't the one doing anything, right?
Exactly.
I mean, at a demonstration. It seems to be like an ongoing sport among some of these police departments.
Well, I think Putin sends in saboteurs into Ukraine to try to get the Ukrainians to do something so that he would be justified in attacking back. I mean, that dynamic is, you know, is old as the hills, you know, and, you know, the idea of, you know, egging on Antifa to come out and fight these militia-type lunatics, Antifa would lose.
Right.
That's the problem when it comes to violence. The right wing has the monopoly on it. This is why I own guns, because I won't have, you know, they're not going to have a monopoly, at least if I can help it.
Uh-oh.
And it's
I don't want to be on your radio show.
Okay. The big brother voice there.
Talk to me, I suppose, in person sometime.